Welcome back to Mountain Money, our first guest, author Danny Kofke. He's a special education teacher. He's not a trained financial advisor, yet he's written 4 books on how to manage money. He joins us on the phone right now. Danny Kofke, thanks for being on Mountain Money.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on, Renee.
Your new book, well, it's new-ish. It came out last year, The Wealthy Teacher, Lessons for Prospering on a School Teacher's Salary. I noticed the title says, The Wealthy Teacher, Not the Millionaire Teacher. How do you define wealthy?
That's funny. I know, right? I think that as well. For me, I know people that are millionaires. They have a lot more money than I do, yet they're miserable. And I don't consider that to be wealthy. So kind of my definition of wealthy is that you do have money in the bank. I mean, we need to have money to live and survive, but that you're also able to pursue those things in life that you feel passionate about or that you feel called to do. And, you know, obviously as a school teacher, I don't make a huge salary. I think, there's other careers that make less than I do, but I think most would agree that school teachers, we are pretty much middle class. But yet, I still have the opportunity that I enjoy being a teacher. I enjoy being able to make a difference in the lives of my students. So I'm able to pursue that. At the same time, I'm able to have my wife. She works part-time now. She was able to be a stay-at-home mom, and we had two young daughters. We have an emergency fund in place. We invest from our retirement. But, you know, I think most importantly, if we kind of have that day-to-day freedom to a degree to kind of pursue those things that we feel passionate about. And that to me is what wealth is about.
So Danny, let's talk about the major pieces in most people's financial lives. You mentioned several of those. One is, you mentioned retirement, you mentioned your home. Another big one is saving for college. Let's talk about some of these big expenses that people need to plan for years ahead of time. What should people be doing to save for college for their kids?
Well, unfortunately, and this is, you know, where we are right now, we have some saved, but not a huge amount. And we're probably going to have to at some point, you know, pay a little bit more and help the kids out a little bit. I don't want them to have to get student loan debt. But the thing is, I've talked to a lot of people, and especially parents, who tend to put our children first, and they'll invest for their kids' college before they do their own retirement. And the thing is, I don't want my children to have student loans, but there's an opportunity that they could, or God forbid, they work while they go to college. But when you retire, there's no such thing as a retirement loan. And all of us at some point, we're probably not going to be able to work. So, you know, I try to emphasize to others to put your retirement before your children. And then when you have money after that that you've invested for yourself, then that's when you can help out with the college. But in our case, you know, right now we only have one debt left, and that's our mortgage. So my goal is, and the mortgage should hopefully be paid off in the next couple of years, and my oldest daughter's in 9th grade right now, so we have a few years until she's in college. But then if we don't have a mortgage payment, that's when we can kind of bankroll the college. Instead of paying the mortgage payment, we can kind of just use that money that would be going towards that to pay for the college.
And let's talk about some specifics. You gave the example in your case. You've got a child in 9th grade. You've got a couple years left on your mortgage. What was your game plan to be able to pay down your mortgage to be in a situation like that?
Well, we first off, when we moved from Florida to Georgia 2006, and we signed up originally for a 30-year mortgage. But then when interest rates went down, we actually refinanced it, and we paid a couple extra $100 a month. But we went from a 30-year to a 10-year mortgage. So that, to me, it kind of really helped out that we lived in a house that we could afford, and it wasn't too extravagant. But at the same time, we're like, you know, we can knock years and years in interest off of this by paying a little bit extra more a month. And, you know, I've talked to people, you can do it yourself. I mean, you can say, I'm going to be disciplined enough to add $100, $200, whatever it may be, every single month of my mortgage. But the difficult part about that is February comes around and we have Valentine's Day. April comes around, we have Easter. Then you have summer vacation. There's always something that comes up, it seems like, every month that money could be going towards. So you have to be really disciplined if you're going to do that. But an easier way for us is by refinancing and going to that shorter term. We kind of automatically locked into it. So we knew, okay, this money is going to pay down that mortgage. And then when you look at it, a lot of people, I mean, you know, we need a place to live, but a lot of people, they don't look at the terms, especially on like a 30, 25-year mortgage, of how much money you're actually paying in interest when all said and done. So that's why I think it's, you know, if you can sign up for it, I think at the most try to get a 15-year mortgage. That way it's paid off so much faster and you're saving that much more in interest.
Well, we know about paying off our debt, but there was one thing I heard you say in an earlier interview that really piqued my interest because, frankly, it's something I don't think a lot of people think about. That's disability insurance, and you called it salary insurance. Why do you call it that?
Yeah, I mean, most of us, we don't plan on getting hurt or injured at the job, but it just is there in case something happens. And, you know, for me as a school teacher, we have my insurance is through the county, so I only pay, I think, you know, and it's before tax, so I pay about $8 a month. And if something were to happen, you know, I'm taking down Christmas lights and I fall off the ladder and I can't work anymore, then it's going to replace 66% of my salary until I get up to that Social Security age. And then that way, you know, it'll take care of the rest once I hit that age. So, and there is Social Security disability as well, but a lot of times that can take, you know, months, even years to get it. So having that disability insurance in place, it is, it's basically paycheck insurance to where if something, God forbid, were to happen and I could no longer work, I know that I'm still going to be able to provide something for my family. And it's relatively inexpensive when it's only $8-9 a month, depending on where you work. Definitely look into it. But for that cost, it's well worth it. Just, you know, and I hope I never, like any insurance, you never want to have to use it, but it's there just in case something crazy were to happen.
I read an interesting statistic that 62% of personal bankruptcies, I think it was 2016 or 2017, were caused because of unexpected medical expenses, and people just aren't prepared for that. You talk about the importance of having emergency funds at the ready. How much should we have saved?
Well, you know, I've talked to many people. I think, you know, we start off, and most financial advisors, they say 3 to 6 months, and I think that's a great thing to aim for, but I understand that's very difficult when we have something like 60% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. So I know that sounds like a large amount for someone that's, you know, barely getting by. So I say aim for first. Go ahead and at first try to save up at least 1 month worth of living expenses. And that may take a while for you to do that, and that's okay. And then after we have that in place, then we aim for the 3 months, and then hopefully we go up to 6 months because you just never know what life is going to throw at you. And it may be job loss. It could be car breakdown. I mean, that's the thing. If you live in a house long enough, the roof's going to leak. If you drive a car long enough, you're going to need new brakes. It's not because you have bad luck. It's just caused life. So we have to be prepared for that. But in addition, you know, an emergency fund, it can take care of an emergency, but you can also call it maybe an opportunity account as well, especially if you build it up 6 months, 7, 8 months, whereas down the road, you may have an opportunity presented to you. And if you're living paycheck to paycheck and don't have any funds set aside, you're not able to take advantage of that opportunity. So having the savings in place can also allow you to take advantage of things that will come your way that, you know, you'll have that margin in place that you're able to take that risk.
Okay, so we've talked about an emergency fund. We've talked about mortgages. We've talked about disability insurance. You know, another place that people stumble is debt, using debt. When does it make sense to use debt, and when should you consider avoiding using debt?
I mean, personally, I don't think you should ever use debt. And I mean, that's just saying it's probably not realistic for many, many of us. But there are times where you can know, okay, it does make sense to do this. For instance, with a house, I mean, getting a mortgage, most of us don't have, you know, depending on where you live, $150,000, $170,000 to buy a house outright. So it's okay to get a mortgage. Once again, we talked about being smart about it, hopefully getting a 15-year mortgage so it pays off faster. Also, we mentioned student loans. If you're smart about it, and the thing is, that's where it's gotten us into trouble right now for a lot of millennials, is they go to college, they take out student loan debt. First off, some of them don't even graduate, so then they have debt and they're not even, you know, working in the career they went into debt for, but sometimes they also are taking debt out to pay for living expenses. So we have to be careful about it. But once again, a lot of people don't have $60,000, $70,000 just sitting around and they haven't prepared. So knowing, you know, if you get a student loan debt that is going to help you get into a certain career to make money, I'm okay with that. But once again, we have to be smart about it. And then also another way, I think, is starting a business. Once again, we got to be smart. I don't want you going out and borrowing a bunch of money. But if you know, hey, I may need just this amount to get this business up and running and it's a chance to produce a profit, then I'm okay with that type of debt too. So to me, anytime you're taking on debt, that could enhance you, that you're going to need to improve your financial situation, I'm okay with. But things, you know, like taking out debt to buy new living room furniture, taking out debt to buy a car, things like that, that those things depreciate in value. So that's where I think we shouldn't take debt out for those things because, you know, like a car, the moment you drive it off the lot, depending on what type of car it is and what year it is, I mean, if you buy a brand new car, you drive it off the lot, it's already lost like $2,000 to $3,000 the moment you drive it out of the lot because of depreciation. So those are the things I don't think we should go into debt for.
Danny, what's your advice for young people regarding building up their credit score and using a credit card to do that? You know, a lot of people 18 to 21, they don't have the mortgage, they don't have the car loan, which is a good thing. But then when it comes time to get their first mortgage, they don't have the credit history. What should people do to manage their credit rating?
You know, I think just pay your bills on time. For me, I'm not a big FICO score. I mean, I know we need it, especially when you're young, but I've never been one of like trying to get that perfect FICO score. And my credit, I mean, it's over 800, but that's over years of paying my bills on time. And I've only had one credit card. And I know there's some people that are against credit cards, and I get that. But, you know, for me, as a teacher, I get paid once a month. So our credit card, I know I have enough money in the bank to cover it. So at any time, you know, we'll do it, and then it gets paid off at the end of each month. So I would say if you are someone young and you're trying to build that credit, be careful with the credit card because you don't want to spend anything using it that you don't already have in the bank. But, yes, it can be a good way to build up that credit. But, you know, like anything, I mean, it's going to take some time to do that. So I'm okay, like I said, maybe getting one credit card, using a debit card, but just be careful, especially with those credit cards, to make sure that you don't spend more than you actually already have.
Danny, it's tricky for teachers who live in higher cost of living areas. When you were talking about buying a house for $100,000, $175,000, I have to admit, in the studio, we kind of giggled a little bit, because in Park City, you're lucky if you find a home for under $600,000. And right. When the teacher is being paid, I think we start our teachers now at $50,000 a year here in the Park City School District. It seems almost impossible to live here and be able to save money at the same time. What do you tell that young teacher who is starting out perhaps in a New York City or a San Francisco or just a place where it's really expensive to live? How do they start?
I mean, that would be tricky. You're absolutely right. I mean, here I'm in Georgia, so the South, I mean, I'm going with home prices there. So, yes, obviously where you are, that's hard. I'm not going to tell you to move, but, I mean, as a teacher, if you're, you know, making 50 grand a year and their house costs 6, I mean, that's kind of a hard. So maybe, you know, you might have to rent out a basement at someone's house, rent a one-bedroom apartment. That really would be tough. So I think you choosing where you live is important. And we need teachers everywhere. I get that. But yeah, that would be really tough if the starter home out there is $400,000 or $500,000 and you're only making 50 grand a year. That's going to be hard. So you're going to have to be really, really careful. And it may be that you do have to rent for a while, or maybe if you're single, you share a house with someone else and you both pay and chip in for the mortgage. So yeah, you have to be a little more creative, I would say, in those higher areas, the cost of living areas, especially when you are on that moderate teacher salary.
Well, it sounds like you and your wife were pretty creative. You guys got used to living off of just one salary because you knew you wanted her to stay at home once you started a family. How did you guys make that work?
Well, I mean, I think it was one of those things that that's all we were used to. So we'd had one car for 3 years. We shared a car. And there were times, my school at that time, we were in Florida, it was about 2 miles from home. There are times I rode my bike to school. I mean, I was the only teacher at the bike rack, and people made fun of me. People laughed, get off your wallet, do this. But we knew we had this goal in place for Tracy to be able to stay at home when we eventually had children. So knowing that, first off, it made it okay to say, okay, laugh at me, whatever. It doesn't matter because I'm working towards this bigger goal. But, you know, secondly, we worked together as a couple, and we felt very strongly about her being able to stay at home. And we just knew going into it, I mean, we knew at that time my salary was about $42,000 a year. So we knew if we had a large mortgage payment, if we had car payments, if we had all these things, she wasn't going to be able to stay home. So I think that was the biggest thing for us, is that before, you know, kind of shortly after we got married, we planned goals together of what we were striving to achieve. And I think that's where a lot of people, now is a good time. I mean, people set New Year's resolutions all the time, and a lot of them concern money and weight, But yet every single year, the same people are setting money goals and weight goals because they're not really specific. So I think that helped us too, is that we said, okay, we're going to need this amount in savings to do that. So we broke it down and said, okay, we need, you know, say $12,000. I'm just going out there. If you wanted $12,000 by this time next year, then you know, if I save $1,000 every single month, or even break it down, if I save $500 every other week or $250 a week, so you can track it as you go along. So a lot of people right now, especially, oh, I'm going to eat better or I'm going to save money, but they're not specific enough. And I think that's what really helped us, is that we set those goals, but they were also specific goals so we could see the progress that we were making towards them.
So Danny, you know, so much of success in life is making thoughtful and deliberate decisions, understanding the trade-offs that you're making. You know, you're really, there's really two versions of yourself. There's the present version of yourself, and then there's the future version of yourself. And the question is, you know, how much do you want to spend on the present version of yourself? And how does that impact the future version of you and your family? And one of the things you were just talking about was frugality. And listeners to the show here know I am not shy about sharing that. I'm a frugal person. Some people ask me, isn't it, you know, I've never owned a new car. And people ask me, you know, don't you want to buy a new car? And not really, but I want to get your thoughts. Is when you were 2 miles away from the school and you're riding your bike there, and you've lived a fairly frugal lifestyle in order to have other things that are important to you, has that been painful? Talk to the audience about being frugal and what those trade-offs feel like.
Right. Well, once again, I mean, we had the goals in place, and I think that was so important. I think it was Zig Ziglar said, if you aim at nothing, you'll hit it every time. So, I mean, we had that goal in place, but I am like anyone. I mean, someone pulls up next to me in a brand-new BMW, of course I want it. But the beauty is I tell myself I can have it, but this is what's going to happen if that happens. You know, right now, my wife, Tracy, works part-time. So I go and do these things, buy nicer things, buy brand-new cars. Well, she's going to have to work full-time. I may have to get out of teaching and get a higher-paying job. It's not a bad thing, but I think a lot of people, they don't think about the future ramifications of the decisions that they are making. So I have, you know, for me, I think it's just because I'm content in what I do. And once again, it comes back to having vision and knowing what you're working towards. I mean, right now, I drive a 2002 car, and a few years ago, I got out of teaching, and I was actually working on retirement plans. I drove across the state of Georgia. I was, you know, putting 10,000 miles on my car every year, just going up and down, and I could have justified buying a different car, a new car, more comfortable instead of my 2002 Ford Escape that I can't even charge my iPhone in because it was made before the iPhone was invented. So I could justify these things, but I have a picture that I look at that a few years ago, we surprised our daughters and we took them to Disney World. And I look at that and I say, you know what? I want to do that for my future grandchildren one day, way, way down the road from now, but I want to have that disposable income. So instead of having a car payment, I put money towards retirement. I put money towards my savings account that I would be paying on a car so I can make that vision a reality. So that, to me, I think the trade-off is, yes, it's very easy to get caught up in today's, you know, what you want right now. And it makes it harder with social media, with commercials, with everything that we're exposed to. But that's why it's really, really important to have goals in place and have things that you're working towards. That way you can say no right now because you know you're rewarding yourself later on down the road. And a lot of times that reward is much bigger than the little thing that you're going to buy today.
So, Danny, your book is titled The Wealthy Teacher, Lessons for Prospering on a School Teacher's Salary. How important is making money at home or having a second job to your formula of living a wealthy life on a school teacher's salary?
Yeah, I mean, I will say, I mean, people think, oh, if you're an author, you're making a bit. I mean, unless I write like 50 Shades of Finance or something like that, it supplements a little bit. But, I mean, you know, most people, I think 98% of authors sell less than 500 books. So, I mean, mine does a little better than that, but I'm definitely not quitting my day job right now to do that solely. But it is important, especially if you're in a moderate income level job. Yes, having side gigs as a teacher. I've worked summer school. I've worked the after school program. I have tutored kids before. So, you know, those are things that I'm able to do. So, yes, if you're in a moderate income level job, absolutely look for ways to make more money. I mean, for us, being frugal helps, but also having a little additional income helps as well. So definitely, I mean, and who knows, you may find something. Like for me, my books actually led to a career. I left teaching a few years ago, and I had a career doing other things because of my books. So you never know what will happen. But I will say, going back, we talked about the emergency fund. So when my first book came out in 2007, the publishing industry was completely different then. So I had to pay basically 1 month's worth of my teaching salary to have my first book published. We prayed about it, talked about it, but because we had that margin in place, we were able to take advantage of that. And then I fast forward now, and I mean, I've been on, you know, a lot of TV shows, over 600 radio shows, left teaching to have a job. So I mean, opportunities happen because I was able to take advantage of that. So that's why I think it's really, really important to have the savings in place, because yes, there may be second career opportunities. There may be side jobs that you can have that could boost your income right now.
So Danny, you're a great example of living what you preach. You obviously have a passion for this. You've done a lot of research. My brother's a high school teacher actually in Ohio, and he has his brother as his financial advisor. And it's really been rewarding because my brother's done a great job. He's been able to save up money for his kids' college. He's got a great retirement. He's made some great decisions along the way. You know, a lot of people just don't have the passion for financial planning and to do the work that you've done to get this education. A lot of people don't have a brother that's in the business that can help them out. So for people that want to work with somebody as a professional to help give them guidance, what should they be thinking about when they're looking for a financial advisor?
Well, first and foremost, you have to remember that the person that cares the most about your money is the one that's staring back at you in the mirror every morning. So, I mean, we have to go with that. So, you know, I would interview a number of personal financial advisors to see which one has my best interest at heart. But a lot of people, you know, at your workplace, a lot of HR departments offer something like that. And there is something, you know, as a teacher, I'm a nonprofit, so we have a 403B. But if you're in a for-profit, your company may have a 401K that matches. And that, to me, you have to take advantage of that. There's a lot of companies that offer up to 4 to 5% of what you contribute that they contribute. So you're getting free money. So it's so important to start there. So if you're in a workplace, go check with your HR department to see. You know, you may have a good financial advisor that your company's already working with that you can sit down and talk with. But, you know, a lot of people, they get freaked out. They think of the numbers. They think, oh, interest rates and you know, what type of stocks, mutual funds. And they kind of get too, you know, especially the average person, they get scared because it's so overwhelming. And I just try to break it down and tell people, think of the beach, think of the mountains, whatever it may be. Basically, your retirement account is your freedom fund. Think of it as that this is money for you to be able to pursue those things in life later on when you're not able to work, or maybe you still are able to work, but those things that you want to do. So that, to me, is where we have to rethink the retirement. It's your freedom. Now, some people want to retire and live on the beach. Well, we got to start putting money aside in order to make that happen. So that, to me, is kind of what I try to tell others and other teachers as well, is don't get you know, boggled down by all the different numbers and what you read in the news. And the most important thing is this is for your future. And the beauty of a retirement account, it's yours. If you start one at a workplace that you're now and you leave job, you know, next year, you take it with you. So it's not like it's tied to the state. It's not a pension. Your retirement account is yours and it follows you. But, you know, the most important thing is you have to get started. And start off with, you can even start it with 1% of your salary. And you know, before taxes, you know, depending on how much you make, but I mean, you may only miss $30, $35 a month just to start preparing for your future.
And Danny, you say to start at 1%. And I agree with you. You have to start with where you're at. But if you save 1% for the rest of your life, you're likely not going to hit your goals.
No, we
both know that. But how should people think about saving? What should be kind of the goal? I think the rule of thumb out there is 10%. A lot of people hear that. Is that sufficient? And if they're saving less than they should be, how do they over time increase that?
Right. Well, and this is where, you know, I start at 1% because a lot of people, yes, they should try to aim for 10 to 15%, absolutely. But you tell someone that, you know, that's barely getting by right now that they need to save that much, they don't do anything. So if we can start small, you do 1%. Then when you get a raise, You know, if you start even at a percent and you get a raise, you don't even have to change the amount because you're automatically contributing more if it's taking 1% of your salary. But maybe every year, try to boost it up 1.5%, 2%, whatever, you know, you're able to do. But you also have to look at your personal situation as well. For me, I'm a teacher and I have a pension. I mean, I guess the pension could go away, but I think, you know, we probably have zombie apocalypse that are going to happen. It'd be something crazy. The pension would be the last thing that we'd have to worry about. But it just depends on what type of profession you're in as well. Do you have to look in, and, you know, that's where it comes to talk with a trusted financial advisor, that you can just kind of look at all the different things that are going to be available to you in retirement. And I know, you know, people say, oh, Social Security may not be there. Well, I mean, I don't know what it's going to look like when I retire, but it's going to be there in some way, some format. It may have to work a little bit longer, but you just look at how many people are solely dependent on Social Security. They can't take it away because there would be too many people that wouldn't have anything. So I think, you know, once again, talking to an advisor, you can kind of look at your overall individual picture to kind of see exactly how much you need to set aside, and depending on what type of lifestyle you have. And, you know, like for us, if we don't have a mortgage, if we're completely debt-free, well, we may not need as much as someone that has a lot of outgo. So I think that's where it pays to just, you know, find someone that, once again, interview a few financial advisors and find someone that can help you out with that.
Danny Kofke, author of The Wealthy Teacher, Lessons for Prospering on a School Teacher's Salary. We really appreciate your time. Anything else you want to tell our listeners before we leave you?
No, I mean, I just know, you know, a lot of people become scared with financial matters. They think, oh, I'm never able to do it, and this is going to be so hard. And I just kind of want to be living proof to people that, you know, if this school teacher can do it, you can do it as well. I've never taken a finance class in my life, but yet we're able to do okay. So I think that is where I just want to give people that hope that, you know, just if I can do it, you can do it.
Words of advice. Thanks so much, Danny Kofke.